This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The head of the McLean County Board tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker that a blue ribbon panel studying the county nursing home may have eliminated its closure.
They've already discovered a number of things that can be done. I'm very positive that our nursing home will be here for a long time.
County Board Chair John McIntyre also answers questions about wind farms and reflects on the election results. Get an update on the three men from Eastern Illinois accused of setting off a pipe bomb at a mosque outside Minneapolis last August. You'll hear from a reporter in the courtroom. And it's an edition of Ask an Expert with help from Redbird Scholar Magazine. You'll learn more about the word fascism and whether the U.S. is moving in that direction. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 22nd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The McLean County Board has narrowly approved an application for a wind farm in the northern part of the county. Work on the future of the county nursing home continues. And in this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, County Board Chair John McIntyre reflects on the defeat of four-decade incumbent County Board member Paul Segabiano in the primary election on Tuesday.
Absolutely. I was stunned by the fact that that Paul lost, having been in place out there on the west side of Bloomington, being a great advocate of the people on the west side all these years. You know, he just received a plaque down in Springfield. He's the longest active member, county board member in the state, 44, almost 45 years now, I believe. He has done such a great job for us. He's chairman of the property committee, was an integral part in helping us work with engineering and architects and getting the jail addition started. Actually made a trip with a number of them down to Atlanta, visited four different models, and came back. So he's put in a lot of extra time with us over the years. I was just thinking this morning about Paul. Sometimes controversial, very much an advocate, though, of the West Side. I was just thinking of the hours that we do put in on a county board level. And if you figure, three and a half to four meetings a month times 45 years, that's thousands of hours and time that he put in for very little pay. So his commitment and his service to the community has been outstanding.
Does he have a signature achievement, or is it legion?
Well, I think, you know, he's come full circle in a lot of ways with our board. I think he served in a leadership role for a number of years as committee chairman, but he was also vice chairman of the board once when Nancy Froelich was the chairman. His signature would be being the West Side advocate, but also serving as an advocate for property and maintenance of all facilities and working throughout our system, pretty much.
The narrative through line of the race was fiery newcomer versus establishment candidate who's been there perhaps too long. When Paul Segabiano was the fiery newcomer, what was he like?
He was a fiery newcomer. It was pretty much obvious. I was younger than him, even back in 1980, in the 80s, on the board. He was very strong in his belief, you know, the shared convictions on wanting to work and support minorities, different diverse groups, people definitely on the West Side, having come from that background himself. He was someone who, obviously, I ran into because of coaching football, because he started a Knockers program, out there on the West Side, and had it for 55 years. Affected lives of many of the kids that were West Siders over the years who went on. And I'm sure he has testimonials, a lot of testimonials as well. And then he, you know, he later on here in the last years, he's had the Stay for Great Plains Life program, helping keep kids in school, raising money for that. And so he's accomplished a lot, and I think those are some of his signatures as well outside the board.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John McIntyre, the chairman of the McLean County Board. The board has now passed another wind farm proposal, making two this year, and to go on top of the several previous ones. That adds significantly to the county's tax base, but the votes are still fairly close. Why is that, in spite of the fact that it's no longer a learning curve for the county to get these proposals through the Zoning Board of Appeals and to the county board? You would think that it's the process is established, the criteria are known, and that it wouldn't be so controversial. Why is it still such a deal?
Well, every issue that we deal with on the board, there's two sides. Obviously, we know that. That's the general answer. Basically, though, it depends on the issues that we deal with people a lot of times affect you indirectly. You know, a tax base, sometimes more so than others. There's a lot of general things. And the services provide the same way. You appreciate the services when they affect you. You definitely don't appreciate things that are a distraction to you or change your lifestyle at all. And so it's understandable that this can happen and it becomes a process. To get back to your answer, Dwight, why do we not have a system? Because we do have a system. We have the Zoning Board of Appeals system who works on this, has a public hearing, in this case, 8 nights of public hearings, where people could voice support and against. Then they have to make that decision. Turn around, we have another layer here of vetting with the county board from a political angle in order to approve, disapprove, or send back to them. Sometimes these issues become very complex because we have 30 days to act on the recommendation, which is a part of the statute. Of the county, of the ZBA's recommendation. Either amend it, send it back with recommendations, deny it totally, or approve it. And so our board made up of 20 members has to fall along with that, put in a lot of extra hours and time, and then make a decision. And sometimes the decisions are based on constituents. Sometimes they're based on taxes. And so there's a lot of driving factors and becomes complex. And I'm happy that we don't have it down where we are just rubber stamping it. We're very close votes on it.
Will they ever become less controversial, or is there a built-in tension because of the nature of that development?
Well, there's the advocates for green energy, obviously. There's advocates for keeping our schools going, and some of our school taxation problems we inherited. Obviously, they're passed down to us. And so, there's the problem of lifestyle. And a lot of analogies can be used, Charlie, and I could give you some. But each analogy is based on your side or your opinion on what you're trying to explain to someone about what is the convenience or inconvenience of living around a wind tower. Another thing that increased the controversy, I think, was the different size of these towers, you know. And I think the problem will continue to be an issue. And maybe even more so if there are attempts to have more wind towers. I think there's other issues involved, too. And part of it is it's a relatively new industry. How proven will it be? I've always voiced a concern about the decommissioning fund. There was the issue came up on our board discussion yesterday about should there be a way to make it right for homeowners if their values went down and how do you assess something like that? You know, if should people, one proposal, one gentleman spoke at almost every public hearing, and at the last minute he proposed that we amend our voting yesterday and give everybody who was inconvenienced money, adjacent landowners. That's one side of the issue. On the other side of the issue is that same gentleman was saying it's not about money. It shouldn't be about money. And maybe he was right, but, you know, we get into contradictory arguments sometimes. So I don't know. I think we do the best we can in trying to take a look at the situation, and then we vote. And we have to make a decision on it. It'll continue to be an issue, I think. Obviously, it should be.
This is Sound Ideas. Our guest is John McIntyre, the chairman of the McLean County Board. The work on the nursing home issue continues. You have appointed a blue ribbon panel to look at that. Update us, would you?
I'm very pleased with the progress that the blue ribbon panel has made. I know we talked about that when I was here before a little bit at the time. In lieu of us to hiring a consultant and allotting $50,000 plus maybe to take a look at our nursing home situation. And if the listeners don't know, we started experiencing a deficit in operation over the last year or year and a half. And last year was $1.2 million. So then I stepped forward and said, well, let's see. There's some great people in this town. Maybe they'll help us. Some are retired. Almost all of them have experience in the healthcare long-term care system, nursing home, some way or another. And so I approached each of them individually, and I was so pleased because all nine people on our board, our panel, agreed to help. And when I'd say, can you help us out with this? And I try to explain a scenario, and I said, I don't know how many meetings there's going to be, but would you take a good look at this? And they have, and it started out right away. They rolled up their sleeves. They came in. I tell you, it's probably been one of the greatest committees that I've been associated with. I'm not so associated now because it was time for me to kind of step back and let them take the ball. They went through initial phases, organizational scheduling, information providing. Our county board staff, I volunteer our staff and myself to get anything they needed. And a lot of these people being former CELs or regional directors or other things came in with, I need this, I need what about this, to give us a set of the financials. And then they sat in and they went through an examination phase, and we were meeting every 2 weeks. And now they're at the point where they are meeting Monday and compiling recommendations. I will tell you that the recommendations then, the progress they're making, will be reported to our health committee, where our idea of having an RFP for a consulting firm originated. And that will be April 2nd. That's a Monday, April 2nd at 4:30. I made that announcement yesterday at our full board meeting. I'm going to invite the public, obviously the media and the public. It's a public meeting, and also the rest of our county board members and interested parties, so they can share and interact with them what they have found. I will tell you that, and I think I can say this, well, from what I've experienced with the committee, they will have three phases. One will be what can be done immediately from what they have discovered. One that could be done within our next budgeting term. And then one, for longer plans.
What happens after that presentation and after the data go to the full board? Are you thinking that there will then be a decision whether to do a formal RFP and work on top of the committee work?
Yeah.
Or will you ask for a policy choice from the board at that time without going to the RFP?
I will, and it's my my job as chairman of the board to go back to the board and say the board had approved you know, putting out an RFP. And there have been a few proposals turned in. I can't tell you how many, but a few, for a consultant. So they have approved that. It's my hope that after they hear what this committee has to say, and I'm pleased with it, that a plan can be formed for our staff to follow.
Without the RFP.
Without the RFP. And it'll be an operating checklist type of thing. I want to tell you also that our nursing home director was invited to come to meetings as a resource and has sat in and provided a lot of information. She's been very willing to do this and very cooperative because, you know, it's a difficult position when you have a group of nine experts come
and
in.
They're talking
and
about your future. Yeah. No one likes that.
No.
Not
no,
easy.
No, but I'm very positive. They've already discovered a number of things that can be done that I'm very positive that our nursing home will be here for a long time to come.
Oh, so you don't think that actual closure or getting out of the business is any longer on the discussion table?
Well, it'll be on a discussion table because we're a political body. But in my opinion, as chairman of the board, if a lot of the suggestions come about and the Blue Ribbon panel interacts with our board members and some of the recommendations are enacted, we will see a tremendous success.
Well, without asking you to give away the store ahead of the public rollout of that, mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that the $100,000 a month deficit can be trimmed?
I can't speak really for them like I would like to in detail because they're still compiling it. All I can tell you is from what I've observed, because it's my job to kind of convene the committee and get them scheduled and off in a direction. So I can't really tell you that, but I will tell you that in a number of areas already they have been able to find ways in accounting and reporting and operations and planning that I feel it will be very successful.
How will you, as chair of the county board, try to structure the debate over this policy, this important policy question, so that it will go forward in an orderly fashion? Are you going to take it through the executive committee or go from the health committee directly to the county board? Will there be public forums after the Blue Ribbon panel submits its recommendations? What are you going to do?
My intentions are to let it come right on through our system. So it'd be the health committee and then to the executive committee and then to our full board. This is a pretty much a board issue. I don't see any reason to have public hearings for this. These are all recommendations and for our staff to follow as well. I'm sure that's where we are with it. But to have a plan in place, and I'm sure it will be pretty comprehensive, and it will include a lot of, and maybe some of the things will require investments as well.
Well, if closure does become a policy option that gets serious discussion, you might want to, do you think you will rethink that? No public input planned stance?
That's a good question. I will do whatever is necessary and to do, I think, to keep the nursing home open. As long as it's been established with our board, to our board, that there is a need for the community. There's a long history of that nursing home. It has a positive and high rating. Yes, there are things that need to be done. Obviously, one of them was operating deficit. Part of that's because we've been victims of what the type of service we try to provide, and that is for people who can't afford nursing homes and the Medicaid. And the Medicaid cuts have definitely affected our nursing home like they have so many. But it's my intention personally, and all I can do is speak for myself, is to see and do whatever it takes to see that nursing home is up and operating and providing the service that it has all these years for our community.
John McIntyre is the chair of the McLean County Board. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker for Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's an edition of Ask an Expert with the help of ISU's Redbird Scholar Magazine. Learn more about the word fascism. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Three men from unincorporated Clarence, a town 35 miles north of Urbana, are accused of setting off a pipe bomb at a mosque just outside Minneapolis last August. Matt Sepik with Minnesota Public Radio attended a court appearance yesterday for two men, plus another who faces a gun charge. Illinois Public Media's Brian Moline spoke with Sepik, who says the alleged ringleader of the mosque bombing is 47-year-old Michael Harry.
He is quite a character, to say the least. He has lived there off and on, has been there for the last couple of years, opened up a business there in an office that used to be part of a grain elevator that was in town for a long time. He is the leader of this group called the White Rabbit Militia, which appears to be an anti-government group. They've put some YouTube videos up. In fact, they put up a series of videos as the FBI was closing in late February, early March, basically espousing a lot of anti-government conspiracy theories and appearing on this video wearing ski masks.
Do we have any idea why Harry and his associates, Michael McWhorter and Joe Morris, would have any reason to bomb a mosque in Minnesota?
Well, that's the big question I'm trying to answer, and people at the mosque that I talked to last week are trying to answer. Why would someone drive more than 500 miles, allegedly, just to target this particular mosque in Bloomington, Minnesota? It's a suburb of Minneapolis.
As you mentioned, Harry's quite a character. I think we could spend a long time discussing his background. But at some point, didn't he spend at least a little time in Minnesota?
It appears that he did. This is a really interesting case. Back in 2005, he kidnapped his two daughters, who were then teenagers, because he feared losing custody to his ex-wife. This was a few years after he was divorced. His ex-wife, Michelle Frakes of Peoria, went to the Dr. Phil TV show hoping to get them back. And the Dr. Phil show hired a private investigator, a former FBI agent who lives in Atlanta. Harold Copas is his name. And Copas went to Mexico and Belize on a tip from some people in this old German Baptist group, religious organization that has a lot of similarities to the Amish in terms of the way they dress and some of their beliefs and so forth. Copas tracked Harry and his two teenage daughters to Mexico and then to Belize, where he found them and convinced them to come back. In 2006, Harry went on trial in Ford County, and a jury found him guilty of kidnapping his daughters and taking them to Belize. He was sentenced to – he received 30 months probation. It appears that a person who convinced him, a member of this old German Baptist community, had lived in Minnesota at the time. So that's the only connection that I see that Harry may have to people in Minnesota. And the man who helped him 12 years ago with this, I don't believe is in Minnesota anymore.
You also talked a little bit with the Ford County Sheriff this week to find out a little bit more about Michael Harry. What did the sheriff have to say?
Sheriff Mark Doran said Harry, in fact, was a deputy sheriff before Doran was sheriff. This was back in the 1990s. He was essentially forced out of that job. And he tells me Harry just really doesn't get along with people in the tiny town of Clarence where he lives. Harry was charged with assault back in July for allegedly attacking a neighbor who'd complained about his dogs getting into his trash. And according to the state's attorney, Harry held the alleged victim, John O'Neill, at gunpoint, tried pushing him into the trunk of a car. I spoke with O'Neill and his wife, Hope, at their home, and they told me Harry terrorized their family last summer, even pressured them to drop the charges. And they said Harry retaliated against them by planting bombs in their shed. This is an area where their kids play, in late February, and then sending in a phony tip to the ATF. That's all outlined, by the way, in the federal complaint against Harry, and it's what led to the arrests.
What's next in this case, Matt?
Well, it's been bound over to the grand jury, so the next step presumably would be an indictment if the grand jury believes that the evidence that the government has presented warrants further charges.
That's Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik, who's covering the pipe bombing of a mosque near Minneapolis last August. Three men from Ford County, the Ford County town of Clarence, have been charged in that case. Two of them were in federal court in Urbana yesterday, along with another man, 18-year-old Ellis Mack, who faces a gun charge along with them. All of the men have waived their preliminary hearings. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Trump administration is raising difficult questions about presidential power, with some suggesting the country is inching closer and closer to a constitutional crisis. Others go even farther, calling Trump's nationalistic America First doctrine the first dangerous step toward fascism. But fascism is a loaded word. In this edition of Ask an Expert, GLT's Ryan Denham got some help unpacking it from the faculty and staff at Illinois State University's Redbird Scholar Research Magazine.
A couple of times a year, we bring in Kevin Bursette into the studio. He's the editor of Illinois State University's Redbird Scholar Magazine. Thanks for coming in today, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Every issue, you've got this feature called Ask an Expert, where you take questions from readers, and then you find an ISU expert to explain the answer in, you know, human English. One of your questions in the March issue of Redbird Scholar Magazine is about America's favorite F-word, which is, of course, fascism. What's this one all about, Kevin?
This came across, I think, on the university's Instagram page, and a student is wondering, could the U.S. ever have a fascist leader?
Who did you turn to for the answer on this, and why?
We turned to Joseph Simpetti, a professor in the School of Communication, who's written about polarization in politics.
That's a very interesting question. And, you know, in some recent presidential elections, both Republicans and Democrats, or liberals and conservatives, have characterized some of the opposing candidates as fascists or fascist-leaning. So it's certainly been, I think, on the minds of many Americans that we might have a fascist leader at some point, or maybe we have had a fascist leader and didn't quite realize it. I think that's a bit naive. Is it possible? To answer the question in short, yes, it is possible. But I personally believe it's relatively unlikely. And that's because we have a number of checks and balances in our system that I think would prevent a fascist leader from taking over. We also know that the president can't do everything him or herself. We have a Congress that checks that. We have a court system that checks that. We even have executive agencies that check presidential action, like the FBI, which, you know, we're currently seeing, right, with the current FBI investigations.
People, as they refer to politicians, sometimes there's hyperbole, right? They say, oh, so-and-so is a fascist. You know, this person is a total fascist. I'd never vote for him. But who is really, like, the prototypical fascist leader, if we were going to just try to be definitional with this thing?
One of the key criterias of fascism is hyper-nationalism. So it's one thing to be patriotic, but that's reasonable, and I think most people would agree that that's a good quality. But when you take it to the extreme where everything about your nation is superior and must be maintained at all costs, even to the point of restricting individual and civil liberties, hyper-militarization, aggressive, confrontive kind of policies in order to secure everything that might be considered national. That's one of the key characteristics of fascism. But that also means that you're talking about something that's very unique to a particular nation. So although we can point to specific historical examples of fascism, like World War II Italy, World War II Germany, Franco in Spain, et cetera, the one thing they had in common was that hypernationalism. But because they had such unique, specific cultural components to their what constituted nationhood for them, the best we can do is really just kind of identify themes of fascism as opposed to a clear-cut definition. We have an authoritarian figure, typically elite economic interests who have some influence, and then extreme hypernationalism as the three main kind of criteria. As I said, many experts and scholars in this field will talk about some other elements, some other common themes, but those are the three primary ones.
What do you make of the kind of the rise of the Antifa movement, which is sort of a short for anti-fascist? And is Antifa actually protesting a true definition of fascism, or are they opposed to kind of broader concepts that are outside the boundaries of what you've just described to us?
As we saw with Nazi Germany, if we aren't conscientious, we could see the rise of a fascist leader, and unfortunately, it might be too late before we actually recognize that. And that certainly is what happened with Hitler, where he secured the popular vote and won the chancellorship in Germany. And although he certainly gave out signals about what his true beliefs were, those didn't really become manifest until after he had secured power. So a lot of people, I think, were duped into thinking one thing and then in reality got something different once he came to power. And so I think that we need to be vigilant, we need to be engaged, we need to be educated, we need to be knowledgeable as citizens in a democracy. But I think that can also be carried too far. And I think that the Antifa movement is illustrative of that, where I think they see, according to their perceptions, some signs of potential fascist policies or fascist qualities in certain politicians, and then they react, the way they do. But I think that we have a lot of other things that we can do and exhaust before we get to that point. I don't think that we need to immediately jump to the conclusion that so-and-so is a fascist and then engage in this Antifa-like response.
All right, Kevin Brissett, editor of Redbird Scholar magazine. If folks are listening to this and they want to hear more, read more from the new issue of Redbird Scholar, where do they go?
They can. All our stories are online at illinoisstate.edu. Redbird Scholar. And if you want to keep up with research at ISU between issues, you can check us out on Twitter at ISU Research.
Before I let you go, I hear that ISU is launching a new magazine called Redbird Impact. What's that all about, and what can we expect?
That magazine is being produced by the Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning, and the idea is to show the positive impact that faculty, staff, and students are having on the community. We feature stories kind of showing in-depth community projects that students are doing sometimes within the class or sometimes outside of the class. One example is we focused on two social work students who are helping to save lives in Peoria from people who are overdosing of heroin and other opioid drugs. We've also focused on a student group here on campus that does free sewing projects. And the idea behind that is to give them some, a community engagement project on campus, but also to kind of bring to light the issue of waste in the fashion industry.
That's Kevin Brissett, editor of Redbird Scholar and Redbird Impact magazines. I'm Ryan Denham.
On the next edition of Redbird Scholar Ask an Expert, an ISU professor does some myth-busting about vegetarianism and protein. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are not afraid to ask the big questions, even to the guy who owns the Chicago Cubs.
Well, there's a few people that just misunderstand something about, like, why beer costs $9 or something like that.
Why does beer cost $9?
Why does a starting pitcher cost $25 million?
We're worth what you pay for us, which is nothing. Join us for the News Quiz from NPR. Listen Saturday at 9 a.m. on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Retrofit Culture, a proudly independent local shop featuring vintage and handmade clothing, home decor, and more at 1014 West Washington Street in Bloomington. Open Tuesday through Saturday with special Sunday hours this winter. More information at retrofitculture.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. If you create a million new chemicals, chances are one or two of them could be a life-saving drug. It turns out bacteria can speed up this shotgun approach to drug discovery. IPR's Christine Herman asks University of Illinois chemistry professor Wilfred Vanderdonk how this works.
Your research group engineered bacteria to crank out more than a million unique chemical compounds. And I wanted to start off by asking, how is this possible?
It became possible when about, already 8 years ago now, we discovered that nature already does this, not millions of peptides, but we found a series of organisms in the marine environment that are making libraries of cyclic compounds, and they are making all these diverse structures from one enzyme that makes all of them. So once we found that, we wondered, well, so this organism makes 30, 50, 80 different cyclic peptides. What about a million? Could the enzyme tolerate that diversity? So we started investigating that, and it turns out that the enzyme is capable to making much, much larger numbers of cyclic peptides than it does in nature. And then we took advantage of that.
So you mentioned these are cyclic peptides. These are chemicals that are like long strands and they loop back on themselves to create essentially a ring structure. Why is this particular feature important?
So there's really two ways by which the pharmaceutical companies are trying to address human disease. One is to make small molecules that binds in cavities of crevices of enzymes, and that has been incredibly successful. Unfortunately, there are certain diseases that cannot be treated by small molecules that bind to cavities in enzymes. And there, the industry has become very interested in disrupting protein-protein interactions. So the idea is, if you cannot stop an enzyme from doing what it is, stop it from talking to its neighbors. And there, industry has been looking at cyclic peptides because they're more stable and they're more organized.
So you found a way to create all of these compounds, and then what needs to happen next to figure out if any of them might become the next life-saving drug?
Sure. Yeah, so our system allows us to go through these millions of cyclic peptides and find ones that bind to a protein of interest for disease. And if we have then a cyclic peptide that binds to this protein of interest, prevents that protein from talking to its neighbors, now the next step is, what is the toxicity of that peptide? Are there anything that can go wrong if you were to give that to humans? Another very important thing is, can it reach the target? If you, for instance, take it orally, can it go all the way to that disease cell to do its job? Those are high hurdles, I have to be honest. They still have to be cleared. But the first start is always finding molecules that have the activity that you want.
So what do you plan to do next with all these compounds that have been created?
Yeah, so the compounds, so the best hit, as we call it, the best compound to disrupt this interaction between two proteins, one is from HIV virus and one is from humans, has good activity but not perfect activity. And so if you look at the theoretical diversity of the peptides we made, it would be 10 to the power 9, and we only looked at millions. So millions sounds like a lot, but the diversity that you can reach is 2 or 3 orders of magnitude larger. So the first thing we're going to do is optimize this peptide. So look if there's even better peptides using this as a starting point. And if we can get even tighter binding peptides, then we're going to be doing what I said earlier, look for its ability to reach the target.
That's U of I chemistry professor Wilfred Vanderdonk speaking with IPR's Christine Herman about new research published in the journal Nature Chemical Biology. You're listening to Sound Ideas. ¶¶
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You usually think of organ music confined to churches. That's not what's happening Friday at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Illinois Symphony Orchestra director Ken Lamb talks with Charlie Schlenker. The Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony and the Poulenc Organ Concerto often go together on recordings. Lamb says they make a good pairing.
Oh, goodness. Well, I mean, they're both French. I think that's an attractive pairing. And, of course, the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony is not quite enough to fill a CD. And so I guess that's what people often think of. You know, there are a lot of other French organ concertos, lesser-known ones. The Poulenc is probably the most well-known. And it's interesting. I mean, the two works are different. I mean, it is very different. I think, you know, the fact that they're both you know, French, I think it's a lot to do with it. And
contrast their sensibilities, would you?
Oh gosh, well, I mean, well, the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony is, well, the way Saint-Saëns use the organ is the organ does not serve a concertant function. It is part and parcel of it is part of the orchestra. It has a prominent part, but it only plays in the second part. It doesn't. It plays in the first part, but it's as well, but very subtly in the first part, in the slow movement. And of course, then it transforms itself into this big, huge chords and in the second movement. Saint-Saëns symphony easier to understand as a whole, because it's, you know, it's very unified, the work, in many ways. It is also very original, because instead of the four movement structure, we have two movements, although each movement is really divided into two parts. It is what we call a cyclical symphony in terms of motifs. So in some ways, you know, it sort of really looked back to something that Berlioz would have done, for instance, in the Symphonie Fantastique. In Saint-Saëns' organ symphony, you hear the motifs really at the beginning of the symphony, and he uses it, you know, throughout the piece, transformed, developed. So in a sense, you know, unlike a lot of Mozart, Haydn, or even Beethoven, you can't mix and match the movements. You know, if you look at a Haydn symphony, you can put, you know, a fourth movement of the symphony and into a first movement, and somehow it still works. And in fact, in the 18th, 19th century, that's regularly concerts would do that. They would not like the slow movement of this symphony and just put another slow movement with it. But with these cyclical symphonies, these movements belong to one another.
What makes it so enduringly accessible? You've got it in everything from television commercials to movies about pigs.
Movies about pigs, yes. You're referring, of course, to Babe, you know, in that
right.
sequence. A lot of times when composers use the organ, it is to augment the orchestral sound. It is to, as if to say that, well, I'm writing for a big orchestral tutti. It's not quite big enough. I want still more to pad it out. But Saint-Saëns uses the organ in, of course, Saint-Saëns uses the organ in that way too, but he also uses the organ in other ways. In the slow movement, it is a very atmospheric. There are ways that in the last movement, it really appears almost as a soloist, almost. I think the reason is so iconic is because of maybe even you think of the squareness of the tunes. You can almost imagine, you know, it is, and the tunes are majestic in the structure.
Thank you.
You know, when he writes a C major chord, he goes for it. You know, he gives the organ the entire span of the instrument with the pedals and so on. And what does the orchestra do? The orchestra actually celebrates it with fanfares and the trumpets and big chords and the strings and timpanies and so on. So a lot about, you know, Saint-Saëns, I think, wrote this when he was in his early 50s, and he said so himself, didn't he? He said, I've given everything of myself in this this symphony. It cannot get any better. It's got great tunes in every movement, and somehow all the themes are linked to each other. And that's why I think we love it so much, is because, you know, we make those connections ourselves. Of course, when you study it, it's incredible.
Tell us about your soloist.
Oh, Felix, yes. He's a German soloist, and he, I think, is a bit of a child prodigy. He's been doing this for a very long time. In fact, one of his feats is to play the complete works of Bach in a very short time. You know, consecutive period of time.
And Bach wrote a lot of organ music.
A ton of organ music. I think it takes days to do that. And of course, the issue with doing a program like this is you've got to have an organ. Well, for this particular organist, there is an organ company in the States that built an organ for him to tour with. It's known as their touring organ model. Of course, it's electronic, but he put everything into a trailer and he just, you know, drives to wherever he plays the concert, I think.
Have you worked with one of those electronic organs before? How does the sound differ?
I played on one. When I was younger, I used to play the organ. And, they're pretty good with technology these days. Of course, it feels a little different. You don't get the. It's interesting. They even imitate the blower, the sound of the blower, you know, with these the electronic organs. So they do a good job.
The organ, as you just mentioned, presents a big transportation issue, and it presents a mastery issue. It's one of the most complex instruments to play. You almost have to have four brains because you're operating both hands and both legs at the same time. Is organ music still alive in a compositional sense in the world today?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. You know, we call it the king of instruments, you know, or at least the organist would call it the king of instruments. The feeling, there's nothing quite like playing the organ to its full range of possibilities. You know, when you pull out all the stops, as they say, you know, and then hit the chords and the pedals, especially when you're playing in a big church, it's overwhelming. And of course, you know, you mentioned mastery of the instrument. I mean, you a lot of the times, you know, people pride in writing independent lines, you know, for both hands and both feet. And you really have to have a number of, you know, different brains to do that. And I'm always astonished how organists can do that. What's also interesting, of course, is that the organ is essentially a wind instrument because, you know, you blow air. And it mimics a lot of brass instruments, reed, woodwinds, and, you know, it has stops where it tries to mimic them. But essentially, the mechanism is a wind instrument.
Also on the program is a bit of Bach. Give us that little lagniappe, would
yes.
you?
Yes. Well, Bach, of course, as we were just talking about, it was an organist. But, of course, this time round, we're actually giving you an orchestral transcription by Edward Elgar, the English composer. This transcription is not a literal transcription. You still get all the notes, but this is basically what Elgar thought Bach would have done had he had the means to a modern-day orchestra.
You know, there have been a lot of things like that. Leopold Stokowski did a whole bunch of transcriptions for the Philadelphia Orchestra of various works, some right. Bach works too. What do you have to do to remain faithful to the spirit while still giving it an orchestral feel?
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned Stokowski's transcriptions, and those transcriptions are literal transcriptions. So Stokowski basically used all of Bach's notes and assigned it to different instruments. Now, he might have put in the timpani here and there, but he didn't really change anything. It's quite a faithful transcription. Elgar is a little bit different. I don't think Elgar was interested in just orchestrating what Bach wrote, but Elgar is more interesting. If I can even use the word almost an expressionist take, what did Bach would have felt? What would Bach have done had he had these instruments? Basically the same ideas. But so Elgar was quite liberal with what he did. You still get the same tune, but you know, you have trombone glisses and harps all over the place and a ton of percussion, and he changes note values and give the orchestra different figures as if to make a point. So, okay, this is what Bach have meant for that gesture to sound like. Oh, he must have. If he had trombones, he would have put a slide there. So it is great fun.
Ken Lamb is the Illinois Symphony Orchestra Music Director. The ISO performs Friday at the BCPA. He spoke with Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Eugene Ormandy conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or at iTunes. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.